I'm Mel Barger, an alcoholic. I want to thank you, Will. That was a better introduction than I deserve. Really nice to come out here, and this nice weather we're having. And we left Detroit a couple days ago. It was so cold it would freeze the ears off a brass monkey. And just nice to be out here and have this time. This is an amazing conference. I just feel complimented to have been invited here. Well, my plan, I think, is to tell my own story and then talk a little bit about some AA history and about Bill and Dr. Bob, if that's permissible. I really like this podium here and the fact that it covers me up just in case I forgot to zip up. At my age, I sometimes forget to zip down. I asked somebody what I could do about that, and they said, well, it depends. But anyway, my story, my sobriety date is April 15th, 1950, and I was 24 years old, and of course somehow I got to be 80 now. I was born out in Nebraska at a very early age in 1925. In September, I turned 80, and also in September, had our 45th wedding anniversary. And this is my trophy wife here. Would you mind standing up? And this is Lori. Yeah. And we have four adult children and eight grandchildren. And then also right next to her is Tina, who is a member of my home group, the Rab Road group that meets west of Toledo. Tina, why don't you stand up? Yeah. Part of my story can be summed up by a little limerick, I kind of composed this to sum it up. A fearful young man from Nebraska drank amounts that would surely aghast you. He'd take any old slop and drink till he'd drop and finally fell on his aska. Nebraska has a lot to do with my story. That's where I grew up and where I finally got sober, in a town in northeast Nebraska. And I used to feel very sorry for myself about growing up in Nebraska. In fact, I was critical of Nebraska. I would say that if they ever want to give the world an enema, Nebraska would be a good place to stick the hose. But that was very unkind, and I regret that now. I retract it, because I'm quite proud of it now, and I go back there, and they're very nice to me. But that's where I finally did get sober, but that's also where I started to drink. I grew up there in the 1930s in the Great American Depression, and my parents divorced in the middle of the 1930s, a very bitter thing. There's a lot of bitterness and unhappiness in my family, and I regret that today, but it was just one of those things. And I got a lot of mileage and self-pity out of blaming everything on my parents' divorce and so on. I think one of the worst things that happened was when I was about 12 years old, I fell into a terrible depression, a terrible fear of dying, and you just can't imagine how bad it was. And everything plunged, my schoolwork, and I never had gotten along well with other kids anyhow, or with the family. And so this just made things worse. And then maybe about a year or two later, I discovered alcohol for the first time. I got into some of my dad's wine. And I found something in that wine that I'd never had before, a feeling of being lifted up, joy or delight. I don't know what you would describe it, but I know that if you had any substance that gave you that feeling, it's pretty hard not to go back to it again. The moment that took effect, I knew why people drank, and I didn't realize I was setting in something in motion that would almost destroy me, because I thought it was saving me. This is the fallacy of alcoholism. We think it's really our medicine. It's the solution to all our problems, and of course, it's the cause of many, many more. I never got along well with my family, my mother and my dad. My father, I think he was something of a rageaholic. I think he was depressed too, but he dealt with it that way. And I had an older sister who did very well in school, but later on she developed serious problems, and she took her life when she was 45 years old. So you see, there were a lot of family problems. I dropped out of school in the second year in high school with only about a year's credit. And then let me go on a little bit about the drinking. After that first experience with alcohol, I didn't become a daily drinker or anything like that, you know, at age 13 or 14. But I went out fishing with an uncle and drank all his beer. And then on New Year's Eve in 1941, just after World War II had started, I was working in an all-night filling station out in western Nebraska. A truck driver and his girlfriend came in with a bottle, and I started drinking with them. And about midnight, the truck driver had knocked me into a snowdrift. I was always hitting people on the fist with my nose. And well, what happened, I was a very shy person without anything to drink, but with just a few drinks, I had a complete change of personality. And today, I see that as one of the signs of alcoholism. If you see a person who is very shy and withdrawn and fearful, and suddenly with two drinks he becomes a different person, well, I think there's an alcoholic. That's one of the signs. I went to Denver and lived there for a while, worked in an army hospital, and I could drink in their PX, even though I was only 16 years old. And after I left that job, and I'd go out there and drink again a few times. So you see, I was making special efforts to find ways to drink. Then I went out to California, and I caught a ride with a guy out of Salt Lake City, and he had a bottle in his glove compartment. And he gave me a couple of swigs from his bottle, and then when I wanted another one, he turned to me and he said, "Kid, you're one of those people who can't drink." Now, he knew this after seeing me take just two jolts from his bottle. Of course, I think he was an alcoholic too, and he was probably trying to protect his supply. He didn't want to share it with me. And I remember he was almost passed out by the time we got to Reno. See, that was Lois. And people came to her for help. She was always ready to help. Now, this was the woman, you know, that helped Bill in the 30s when he was bringing people to their home and everything else, and did all the cooking, earned the living and everything else. Really, probably if it hadn't been for Lois and also Ann, we wouldn't have had these two founders. I worked up a PowerPoint program with some illustrations, and I finished it by pointing to the four people most responsible for the origin and growth of AA. It includes Ann Smith, Dr. Bob, Lois, and Bill, these people. Took all of those people, really, to get this thing going. So then, while working on this, you just discover lots of little pieces of information. I found that when Lois and Bill became engaged, there had been a young fellow. Now, this was in Manchester, Vermont. And the reason they met is Lois's family always summered in Manchester. And they were called summer people around there. See, Manchester had two classes of people. There were the native people who lived there all the time, and then there were the summer people, and I suppose the summer people looked down on the people who lived there all the time, something like that. And there had been a young fellow from Ontario that wanted Lois to marry him, and his name was Norman, and his family was one of the wealthiest families in Ontario. In fact, Norman eventually became a member of Parliament up in Ontario, very distinguished man. Well, I went up to see Lois this one day, and a young Al-Anon woman from Manchester was with me. Her name was Melanie, and she was very much interested in AA history. And somehow we got to talking about Norman. And Norman had asked Lois to marry him the very day she and Bill got engaged. But they still exchanged Christmas cards. They're still on a friendly basis, and Norman was now in his 90s, still living. And so Melanie says, "You know, Do you ever stop to think what your life would have been like if you'd married Norman? Especially when things got real bad. Now, things got very bad for Lois, you know, after they became destitute in the 30s, and Bill's drinking. Bill was not a very good husband. He had a lot of shortcomings as a husband. And anyway, said, "Do you ever stop to think what it would have been like with the road not taken if you had married Norman?" And Lois says, "Never. It was always Bill Wilson." You know, bad as Bill got at times, he was always the great man in her life. And that's just a wonderful thing about it. I think it probably was the same way with Ann Smith, too. With all of Dr. Bob's deficiencies, he was still her man, and she stood by her man and all that kind of thing. So these two guys, Akron and New York and all of that, it's just a wonderful story, and there's many facets of it. Now, I've written five books since I worked on Pass It On, and they messed up that story. I've written some books for Hazelden. And the first one was called New Wine. And it's about the spiritual roots of AA. And there's a lot of stuff in there that they took out of some of the stuff I wrote for Pass It On, which I think should have been included, especially some of the Akron stuff. And so that book was published by Hazelden, and it's done fairly well. And then I did a meditation book called Walk in Dry Places. And, you know, my wife and I still use that for our daily meditation. And every now and then she'll say, "God, I'd like to meet that guy. He's really got it together." And then I did another book about Ebby, the man who sponsored Bill W. Now, you know, Ebby had a lot of trouble. He stayed sober 2.5 years, and then he got drunk in 1937 and had a lot of trouble the rest of his life. But one part of the story is that Bill was always loyal to him, never lost his gratitude to Ebby for what Ebby had done. And then also that we should feel the same way, that for the time he did stay sober, the 2.5 years, Ebby did some things that were very important for the future of AA. These things are important to remember. Ebby did have about 8 good years down in Texas. They spirited him down there in 1953, and he stayed there until 61. And the Texas members treated him very well. They kind of lionized him, you know, as one of the founders of AA. So he had a lot of sobriety down there. But then he started drinking again and got back up into New York. And the last 2 years of his life, Ebby was being cared for in a home about 25 miles north of Albany, which is his hometown. And I met the woman who took care of him the last 2 years of his life, wonderful woman. Her name was Margaret McPike. She was AA member and also a practical nurse. And she and her husband ran this little care home up there. And that's where they took care of Ebby the last 2 years of his life, and Bill had arranged all of that. He always took care of Ebby, always even raised a fund for him to take care of him in the last couple of years of his life. So we can feel pretty good about that. Then I did one more book. It was called My Search for Bill W. And this is also published by Hazelden. I'm really pushing my books here, ain't I? But talking about the traits that I think Bill had that enabled him to become the person he was, the founder of AA. And he was a peacemaker, he was an entrepreneur, a good communicator, a fixer, a guy who liked to fix things. I think I found 7 Bill Wilsons there. Now, this book never had a big sale. It's still there. But one night my son called, our oldest son from Dallas, he called, and he wanted to know if the phone was ringing off the hook. And what had happened, a session of The Sopranos, one of the thugs had gone into rehab, and they had him reading my book, my Search for Bill W., Mel B., right on the cover. And I got 5 or 6 calls about that just right away, people in Toledo and everything else. So I went to my group, and I told them, I says, "You folks better start treating me a little better, because I'm now tight with the mob. So, anyway, I could go on and on all day long about some of these things. In 1958, when we had that service for Bill W. at Dr. Bob's gravesite, the one that has ballooned into thousands of attendees every year, I took some nice pictures of Bill and just happened to have a Rolleiflex camera with me in the car. And he gave me permission to do this. And several of them have now been used in books that have been published about Bill. And I put one on the Internet. If you wanted a copy of it, just go into Google and put quotes around Hindsfoot, Hindsfoot, and you can pull up that picture and print it out if you want to. And I plan to put anything else that I can on the Internet so everybody can share it. Incidentally, I'm very grateful to Al Gore for having invented the Internet, because things that you never could do before, thanks to the Internet, you can now do them. I mentioned that I'd written some articles for the Grapevine, 55 that have been published, but about 10 or 15, they wouldn't accept them. So I put them on the Internet now, and anybody can have them. And there are a lot of things you can do that way. And if some editor doesn't think your work's okay, maybe somebody out there in the boondocks wants to read it. Thank God for the Internet. Another great thing that has been done is the Grapevine has digitized all of the articles it ever published. Something like 12,000 articles are now available over the Internet. I think it costs $10 a year. It's called the Grapevine Digital Archive, and you can pull up articles on any subject. It's just wonderful. I find that if I want a subject and to go to a meeting and talk about it, sometimes I pull it up on the Internet, print it out, make 20 copies, and take it to the meeting and pass it out. Just these are wonderful things that you never could do in the old days. So this technology is really doing us some good. I have just about finished what I want to say here, and I have a little practice of, God, this is almost embarrassing. I'm really kind of imposing on you. But when I was in the sixth grade back in Nebraska, I went to school there with a fellow who became a famous television personality, and he used to laugh at me all the time. And he would come here to the Riviera and get $50,000. Well, I come here and I get a free lunch. And anyway, when I was in the sixth grade, I thought I could sing. And the teacher assured me that I couldn't sing, but I wanted her to give me a try, and I got up in front of the class, and not a damn thing came out. And everybody laughed at me. And I was 38 years old before I could finally sing a song in public, and that came about, by the way, through AA. And so I kept on. I'm still taking singing lessons today at age 80. And I sang a few years ago for an older couple that got married out in Palm Springs at an aviation convention. A guy came up later, and he said, God, I always wished I could sing. Now I wish you could. And but anyway, I have this song that I wrote using a tune that was developed up in Canada, and it's called Once There Were Founders, and it's a tribute to Bill and Bob, and that's the way I'd like to close my talk. Once there were founders, two men we esteem. They had a vision, a sort of a dream, and though they had struggles, they'd never complain. I wish they were with us again. Once there was darkness, no answer was known. Each of us faced a grim future alone. Then came their vision, and new life appeared. Our founders were with us back then. Can you imagine their place in the universe? Higher than princes or kings, they opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders, we honor them still, a doctor named Bob and a broker named Bill. Dim was the path when their journey begun. I feel they're now with us again. And over the long years, their stories were told, and lost souls began to return to the fold. All that they told us turned out to be true. I wish they were with us again. Can you imagine their place in the universe, higher than princes or kings? They opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders, both gentle and kind. They gave us this program. It's yours and it's mine. When we came broken, they helped us to mend. I wish they were with us again. So remember the gift from the founders we love, with help from our friends and the power above. Each day we have is a journey begun. I feel they're now with us again. Yes, I feel they're now with us again. Now, this was early in 1942. Then I lived in the Vallejo, California area for about a year and did quite a bit of drinking there. Now, that's where I heard the term wino. That's right next to Napa, the Napa Valley, where all the wine is produced. And wine was so cheap there, there were little neighborhood stores with barrels in the back. You could go in and fill a fruit jar full of wine for 15 or 20 cents, or anybody who could mooch 50 cents on the street could stay drunk all day. But I didn't want to be a wino, and because there'd be one or two goofy guys, and they'd say, he's a wino. But I wound up drinking a lot of wine. It was only after I got an AA that I discovered that a wino is no different than a Biro or a whiskey-o. We drink it for the alcohol, that's all. No matter, that's what we're looking for. And if you see a bunch of guys who are sitting around drinking wine, they're not partial to wine. If you bring in a bottle of Chivas Regal, they'll drink that too. Then I got back to Nebraska somehow, and after a few months, I joined the Navy in May of 1943. And I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but the war started turning in our favor just that month that I signed up. But it wasn't due to any expertise or action on my part. And in fact, I have to admit that if everybody in the armed services had operated at my level of competence, Hitler would have wound up in the White House. But anyway, I thought that the thing you were supposed to do in the Navy was drink. And of course, there were a lot of people in the Navy who didn't drink, but that was my impression. So I did a lot of drinking and San Diego and places like that, and when I went home on leave. I look back on that. Those were considered joyous times there, and now I look back on it as being very, very sick. And some bad things happened in the Navy, but none of it got on the record. But there was one event that stood out. I was on an amphibious type of ship. They called it an LST. It had bow doors, would go right up on the beach and disgorge vehicles, tanks, and so on. And we were out in the Western Pacific on these island-hopping campaigns. It was the closing year of World War II by that time. And we didn't drink on the ship. We couldn't drink on the ship, but they carried beer. And when we went somewhere where you could have a Liberty Party ashore, they would let you go ashore and give you three cans of beer. And we were anchored in the Philippines, all loaded up with troops and supplies off the island of Samar. And they let some of us go ashore to a recreation area on the beach. And as I got out of the boat, we used our landing boats for Liberty boats. a Filipino came up and his shirt was stuffed with bottles, which he said was potato whiskey. It was in beer bottles. And I had no idea of buying any of that. It was $5 a bottle. It was not because it was $5, but I was afraid of the stuff. We had been warned, you know, that some of the stuff you might drink could be pretty bad. So I had my three cans of beer. And another guy gave me his three cans of beer. And then another guy sold me his three cans. And suddenly there's no beer left on that beach. What did I do? I looked up the potato whiskey man. And I bought one bottle, and I remember buying a second bottle. And then the next thing I knew, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, 0400 Navy time. And I was in the boat, on the bottom of the boat. They had hoisted it on the davits and just left me there. And God, what an awful thing it was. Somebody had come up and thrown up on me and or done something like that. That's what was always happening, you know. There was always somebody coming in and urinating on my bed when I drank. excuse me. So, anyway, I didn't get anything out of that experience until after I got an AA. A few days later, we were on the invasion of Okinawa, which was April 1st, 1945. And I got a picture from the Navy of my ship on that day. And I think I was still sick several days later. But it didn't occur to me to look back at that experience and realize that when I was perfectly sober, perfectly dry, I could turn down something that appeared to be dangerous. But after 9 cans of beer, I threw all caution to the winds. And that's what happens to alcoholics with your good intentions. You can have the best of intentions. And then after a few drinks, everything changes. There's a movement now. I've picked up something on the internet. They call it harm reduction. They try to teach alcoholics to reduce the amount of harm that might be caused during a drunk. And maybe not to quit altogether, but to behave more responsibly and sensibly. You know, we've tried all that. You know, you ever try to get an alcoholic to give you his keys, his car keys? You know, they don't do that. Harm reduction would be, of course, to give your car keys, not drive and do things like that. But it just doesn't happen that way. Once an alcoholic has a few drinks, all bets are off. Well, I went back to, got discharged from the Navy in late 1946. Had a good conduct medal, one enlistment with a nothing on my record, but I wasn't entitled to that because I'd done a lot of things that were pretty bad, even stolen government property and sold it and stuff like that. None of that got on the record. So I had this good conduct medal, honorable discharge and all that. Went back to Nebraska, and you know, I stayed continuously drunk until the money I'd saved up was gone. And by 1947, I started getting shut off in bars now and then. I'd go down to Omaha and go in a nice bar and maybe have a couple drinks, and then the bartender would come over and take the glasses away so I wouldn't throw them at him and tell me to take a hike. So, you know, something must have happened. These bartenders must have radar so they know who a bad actor is going to be. Well, I wasn't always that bad. I said some bad things, but I never got really physically abusive. Threw anything around or anything like that. And then I wound up out in Idaho where my dad lives and never got along well with my dad, which I regret today. That not even after I got sober, it never was all that comfortable. But I stayed there for a while, and my drinking started to cause problems, and finally I left briefly and wound up on the Idaho-Oregon border, destitute, and ashamed to go back to where my dad lived. So I went out and I went to work on a railroad Gandhi gang. Now, these were guys who worked up and down the Union Pacific Railroad. They lived in railroad cars and they worked on the tracks. And God, that was an experience there. The food wasn't bad. The railroad cars, the accommodations here at the Riviera are much better, I can tell you that. But these guys, what scared me was the lives these guys had led. Some of them had worked up and down that railroad for 15 or 20 years and only had the clothes on their backs, and they'd been in every jail on the line. They talk about, well, you don't want to get picked up in Pocatello. The cops are terrible there, or Salt Lake City is a lousy place to get arrested in. It was that sort of thing. Well, I didn't want to be like those guys. But, you know, I got a paycheck and went into town and started shooting a game of pool with a guy. And he handed me a beer. And, my God, the next morning I wake up in jail. And I don't even know. It's a little town of Weezer, Idaho. And I wake up in this jail at 1:30 and didn't even know how I got there. I mean, about 6:30 or 7:30. What had happened, I found out, is at 1:30 in the morning, they had found me passed out on the sidewalk. Well, it's not too cold there, but you can see how I could have fallen asleep in some place of freezing temperatures and frozen to death. This happens to alcoholics, too. And there again, somebody had thrown up on me in that jail. And so I had to wash my shirt out and go into police court with a wet shirt and everything. But the judge kind of took pity on me. They found a card in my wallet that said I'd been in the Navy, and he thought I'd been hurt or something. Well, I got out of that. And then I went back and stayed with my dad for a while. And then I go over to Boise and get drunk over there and take a cab 30 miles without a cent to pay the cab driver. Can you imagine? Well, I don't know what I had in mind, but anyway, I got a 10-day jail sentence out of that. Well, shortly after that, I had another argument with my dad and left and hitchhiked all the way down to Ventura, California, where my sister and brother-in-law lived. And I spent that summer there. I got a job working in the oil fields, which I'm completely not fitted for. Whenever I see a picture of guys working on an oil derrick, I just shudder, you know, thinking what that work was like, and also with a hangover. But anyway, my drinking got so bad that summer that in October, I said October of 1948, I get in touch with AA for the first time. And I went to my first AA meeting in Santa Paula, California, a little town about 9 or 10 miles from Ventura. Now, I fell in love with the people I met in AA there. Two of the first three AA members I met were from Akron, which, of course, we consider the birthplace of AA. One of them was one of the first 2,000 members of AA, and the other one, his son-in-law, was one of the first 200 members. I didn't know it, but that was the first step on my becoming an amateur historian in AA. And they talked about some of the people. Dr. Bob's wife was still living. They mentioned Bill Dotson, who was AA number three, anonymous number three, as you read his story in the big book. And one of them called him the guinea pig. But 2 years later, about 4 years later, I would meet Bill, and there was something would come up about that. But anyway, I stayed sober 5 months, and then somehow joined the Army, and I spent 7 months in the Army and got kicked out with an undesirable discharge. Now, that was a very bad period in my life. What happened in that 7 months would be almost a story in itself. Wound up going to Europe, but not seeing it except from a railroad car or from the guardhouse or the hospital window or something like that. My wife and I went to Europe about 4 years ago and had a really quite a nice time, and I found out what it looked like. But anyway, I got back to New Brunswick, New Jersey, got kicked out of got this undesirable discharge, and woke up the next morning on a lawn on the edge of town, and my money was gone, my belt and my tie, my railroad ticket, and even my undesirable discharge. There's somebody in New Brunswick who has an undesirable discharge he didn't earn. Now, about 17 years later, a retired Navy man helped me get that discharge upgraded through a board in Washington. So it's a general discharge now. They got that changed. They've become a little more tolerant of alcoholism in the military services. I don't think they throw people out with that kind of a stigma attached to them. But that's what happened to me. And maybe it was my comeuppance for getting that good conduct medal and everything when I was in the Navy, the one I didn't deserve. Then I get this undesirable discharge, which I did deserve. And I went back to Nebraska and lived with my stepmother, or my mother and my stepdad, for the winter of 1949 and 1950. And I still look back with some regret about imposing on them. There I was, 24 years old, and I worked a few times, but mostly I was just a kind of a leech. And what I was, though, was also in deep depression and fear, probably almost suicidal and everything. But in the back of my mind, I knew that AA worked. And finally, in April, a neighbor lady took me out to the state hospital, which was on a hill overlooking my hometown. And I remember when I was growing up there, people would always talk about out on the hill. You know, boy, you act like that, boy, they'll take you out on the hill. And this was a state hospital in Nebraska, in Norfolk. And, you know, I've always lived in places that, for some reason, people made fun of. They made fun of Norfolk because of the state hospital. And then later, when I lived 19 years in Jackson, Michigan, where there's the world's largest prison, walled prison, they made fun of Jackson because of the prison. Now I've lived in Toledo. We've lived in Toledo 33 years, and people make fun of Toledo. And I don't know why. They had a contest up in Minneapolis, and the first prize was a week in Toledo, and the second prize was 2 weeks in Toledo. And, you know, John Denver had his song about Toledo and so on. But where was I? Well, I got out to that state hospital. And I spent 7 weeks there. And I got back into AA then. And I've been in AA ever since. Been sober ever since. Never taken another drink. And never stopped going to meetings. And that was the start of it. But I had to be in this state hospital. And very humiliating place to be in. But it was a good thing. One of the AA members who was also a minister up in Detroit, he would say, some of the worst things that happened to me have been the best things. And he used his alcoholism as an example. It was one of the worst things, but it became one of the best things because of what he found in AA. And so I have to say that about this state hospital and things like that. Sometimes they appear to be bad breaks, but if they lead to something good, well, they weren't so bad. Maybe that was our higher power's way of getting our attention and getting us on the right track. Certainly it worked that way for me. And a few months after I got out of the state hospital, I was active in AA then, going to meetings regularly, and I moved out to Pontiac, Michigan, where I had relatives. And they owned a little machine shop, and I lived with them for 6 months and worked in their shop. And these relatives were very kind to me. They didn't think much of AA, though. They were quite religious people in some sense. And they just thought that, you know, people that drank, they were just bad. Drinking was bad and so on. And my cousin, their daughter, had married into a quite affluent family, so they were all pretty well off. And so it was very nice to be with these people. They would invite me to dinner in their homes and everything. And so just here I was, a destitute guy, just getting started in AA, and had these nice things happening to me. But, you know, the irony of this is that now, 55 years later, the one family had a very nice family restaurant between Pontiac and Detroit, a very profitable one. And then the machine shop also was very successful. But younger members of the families took those businesses over and drank them up. Both businesses are gone today, and it was all because of these younger members of the family. And I remember that they looked upon me as a kind of a lost sheep, you know, the prodigal son kind of taken back. But without knowing it, I was on the right track because I had AA. And some of these other people came along and developed drinking problems, and they didn't have AA. They didn't have what we found, and it didn't work so well. When I was the 55th anniversary of going out to Michigan, I called up my cousin's husband and wanted him to have lunch with me up in Bloomfield Hills. And I just wanted to tell him again that I was grateful that they had given me this job when I came out there. But he had lost a lot of money over selling the machine shop to his former son-in-law. And he said the son-in-law had even taken $100,000 out of the business and come out here to Las Vegas to invest it. And, of course, that was gone and stuff like that. So I have a lot to be grateful for. And anybody who helps us along the way, sometimes even people who try to hurt us, maybe we should be grateful to them because of what lessons we learned in the process. So right from that start then, things started to improve. I started to work regularly. I went down to Detroit and worked in an engine plant there for a little over a year. And then in 1952, I got a job in Jackson, Michigan with a very fine company. It just came about through some miraculous, almost like coincidences. But that's where I lived from 1952 until 1972, except for 1 year when I went down to New York on what appeared to be a great job opportunity. Didn't work out all that well, but anyway, from 1952 until 72, lived there in Michigan. You know, Michigan is in the shape of a mitten, and this part of it that we call the thumb. And Jackson is here, and I like to think of Michigan as being God's hands, and I was in the palm of his hand when I lived in this town, because I had fine AA, and that's where I met my trophy wife in 1959. I had become an amateur actor. And that was one of the things that AA allowed me to do. And I had the part in the Great Sebastians. And there's one scene where Sebastian runs across the stage in his underwear. And she was doing the artwork for the show. And I know that when she saw me in my underwear, she said, I had to have that man. Anyway, I'd like to talk a little bit about AA history. Well, a couple of the things that did happen to me, though, as a result of the program. One of them, I was working in this engine plant in Detroit, and I'd always had trouble working with people, getting along with other people. But with the AA program, I was trying to follow the principles, you know, when you're working with people, trying to be considerate of the other person and so on, trying to do your part. But there was one guy that was making himself very obnoxious. And we had a job working on these engines. It was kind of an assembly line where you push the engines along on rollers. We were putting special parts on these engines. And he kept telling me not to put my hand behind the engine when I pushed it to the next station. Well, sometimes I'd forget. And one day, I started to push the engine, and I forgot about that. And I just happened to look around, and he was pushing the other one. And he had a look of rage on his face, and just like that, and the two came together, and I just managed to pull my hand out in time. Well, that would have broken every bone in my hand. Now, there was a wrench laying right there, and just for a moment, an electric current went through me, and I felt like picking up that wrench and working him over. Just a moment, you know. And then suddenly, I had no feeling at all. I just went on about my business, and I suppose maybe in 2 or 3 weeks he was bumped to another job. That's the way it kind of worked in that factory. Well, that was in 1951 or 52. And, you know, if I'd picked up that wrench, I would still know everything about that guy. And I mean, it just would have changed everything completely. But thanks to the program and the fact that I was trying to follow these principles, I think something was protecting me and protecting him, too, of course. So that's the way it works. There are times when we're out of control. Emotionally and everything else. The big book even says there are times when we're up without defense against the first drink, and it's a good thing to remember that at all times. Well, I think there are times we're without defense against anger and that kind of thing, too. So that was one case where I just felt the program working. And then when I got a better job working up in Jackson, I was working with a bunch of young fellows who were better educated than I. I was really only a high school dropout. I had gone to college a little bit after the war, but I didn't feel like I was a high school graduate, even. And I was working with these fellows. They were all college graduates and everything. And our coffee breaks turned out to be gossip sessions. Well, I enjoyed being included in these sessions, but then I didn't enjoy them too, because I'd feel guilty later on in the day. We would have talked about somebody, and I'd see the person later on in the building, and I'd feel kind of guilty. Well, it's the AA program that works. When you do something wrong, why, you know, you don't feel right about it. So I started mentally withdrawing from these gossip sessions. And you know, a funny thing. Now, with those sessions, you were always afraid to leave first, or then they stopped gossiping about you. But the moment I quit mentally engaging in that, cooperating with it, I stopped fearing being gossiped about. So I think if you're afraid of people talking about you, you better look at your own thoughts and behavior. Maybe you're projecting something that you're doing. Because when you quit doing it, well, you lose the fear of it. Well, that was another thing where I saw the AA program working. And also, as time went on, they had a company magazine in 1955. Now, I'd always wanted to do some writing. Now, here I am, a high school dropout and everything, and didn't even do well in English classes, didn't learn all the rules, and yet here I feel I should write. Well, I started writing articles for the company magazine. It was a pretty good magazine that went out to 40,000 people, and they spent a lot of money printing it, mostly articles about customers and that kind of thing. Well, before long, I'm editor of the magazine. And then I get an article published that year in the AA Grapevine. And that was the first of 55 that have been published over the years. And then that did something for me. So kind of through the back door, I became an industrial or business writer and have been that ever since. And I've had 5 books published by Hazelden, which I'll mention later. And I want to tell you that all of those books would be bestsellers, except that millions of people have chosen not to buy them. Well, anyway, there was this interest in AA history that kept on. In 1951, for example, Bill Wilson came out to Detroit, and he was barnstorming the whole country to promote what he called the Third Legacy. This was the General Service Conference. Dr. Bob had died the previous November, and Bill was always talking about what's going to happen to AA after the Undertaker gets us founders. See, he was always putting it in that kind of a language. And so the idea of the General Service Conference, or the Third Legacy, as he called it, the first two legacies were recovery and unity, and the third one was service, and that was the General Service Conference. And so he was promoting that, and I went down to Detroit on a very cold night to hear him, but I never met Bill. But then in 56 I did, and I wrote to him and got a very long letter that just astounded me, and got to know him in 1958, went to Founders Day in Akron and took some pictures of him at Dr. Bob's gravesite, a service they started having there. There were only about 36 people. Well, you know, I came back 20 years later, and there were thousands of people in this cemetery, covering the whole cemetery, and quite a thing. But I went down to Akron in 1952 in November and spent a day with Bill Dotson just to find out more about how AA had got started. We consider Akron the birthplace of AA, and I've been there many times. Was there this past Sunday. They had a Gratitude Sunday for old-timers, and this was in the house right next to Dr. Bob's house, which, by the way, is now an AA shrine. They've even got a monument in the front yard denoting that this is where AA was started. It's the very thing that Dr. Bob didn't want for himself, why they have. They bought his house, and then they bought the house next door for the archives. And so every November, they have a Gratitude Sunday for old-timers. But every time I go over there, I get a strong feeling about how Bill and Bob met there in 1935 and what has taken place since and how we have benefited from it. And it was all just the things they just did to help themselves because they were desperate people looking for answers. But then we have all benefited from it. Bill somebody asked me the other day, now see, I heard Bill talk several times, and then in 1963, I made a job change, went down to New York, and worked for a brief time for the Wall Street Journal. And it didn't really work out in the long run, but we were down there for about a year living in New Jersey, and I got to know Bill a lot better. I was on the Grapevine editorial board by that time, and he would come to the meetings we'd have every month. Somebody asked me, what was there about Bill that I would remember more than anything? And I think it's that he was a very considerate man, one of the most considerate people that you could ever meet. There was just something about him. If he had ever hurt anybody unintentionally, he would just feel terrible about it. He was that sort of a person. Lois, his wife, even said that he wouldn't walk across somebody's lawn, to take a shortcut or anything like that. He was just considerate of everybody. He was a tall man, about 6'3", and he talked with a kind of a twang, like some of those New Englanders do. He had grown up in a little town in Vermont, East Dorset, which is about 7 miles north of Manchester, which is a resort town. Manchester, Vermont, still is today. You go there and they have very fine bread and breakfasts and things like that. It's a beautiful place in the Green Mountains in Vermont. And he had taken a lot of shocks growing up. His parents were divorced when he was 9. I identified with him on that. And his mother was a very abusive person. But she went off to, after her parents were divorced, his father went off to British Columbia. He was a quarry man who ran quarries and that kind of thing. And then his mother went off to be an osteopathic physician, leaving Bill and his sister with her parents. Well, from one standpoint, his grandfather was quite well off, and so he had everything he needed when he was growing up. But they had that sense of abandonment, that their parents had abandoned them. And this is an awful thing if you feel that your parents didn't really want you. I know when my sister took her life, she was 45 years old, and she had a 3-year-old daughter. And I thought, well, she'll never be affected by that. And a few years ago, she wrote to me. She's now 40 years old and has a doctorate and everything else. But she felt that her mother had abandoned her when she learned that her mother had taken her life, that kind of thing. So, boy, we can really be affected by these things, can't we? Well, anyway, Bill became a stockbroker in New York, and he had a terrible drinking problem, and this is all covered in Bill's story in the big book. And he got in touch in 1934, at what turned out to be his last drunk. One of his old friends called on him, and the fellow's name was Ebbie Thatcher, and told Bill about something he had learned from a group called the Oxford Group. And Bill found those principles. He talks about it in his story. Had a spiritual experience, which I believe today was a touch of grace, a form of illumination, we might call it. And then for 5 months, he kept sober himself and tried to pass it on to other people. Now that's what another significant thing about Bill Wilson is, having found something good, he tried to share it with other people rather than just thinking about himself. And he went out to Akron on what they call a proxy fight, trying to take over a little machine tool company. The thing fell apart, and it was through that he called somebody in the Oxford group and got in touch with Dr. Bob. And, we've read about that story many times. Well, Dr. Bob was also a Vermonter. He was about 15 years older than Bill, and he was a physician in Akron. He had gone to medical school. Now, his story, it's called Dr. Bob's Nightmare in the big book. He had to change medical schools simply because of his drinking problem. He started at the University of Michigan and then wound up at the Rush Medical College in Chicago, and then got his internship in Akron at City Hospital. And after he opened his office, he started drinking. When he was doing his internship, he hardly ever left the hospital, but then he started drinking, and it was a very sad story, what happened to him. It was just about out of business completely by the time Bill called in 1935. But there's an interesting thing. The Oxford Group had somehow come to Akron in 1933. And this was because a member of the Firestone family had been helped by an Oxford grouper. And Harvey Firestone, the great tire pioneer, he sponsored this rally. And this 1933 rally, Dr. Bob's wife attended. So did some of the other people who had helped the early AAs. And so they started an Oxford group in Akron. And Dr. Bob started attending these meetings. And he tells about it in his personal story, about falling in with this group of people. They had some kind of a spiritual program that didn't interest him much. But he admired the people because they seemed confident and at ease and all of that. And he was uptight all the time. So he went to their meetings for 2.5 years. Now, listen to all these principles, same kind of principles we have in AA. But he got tight every night nonetheless, he said. Well, then about 3 weeks before Bill Wilson called, a woman named Henrietta Seiberlein, who was a member of the Oxford group, she decided to have a meeting and get Dr. Bob to admit what his real problems were. He had been going to these meetings for 2.5 years and never admitted that he was an alcoholic. So they all admitted some very embarrassing things about themselves. Well, finally, when it got to Dr. Bob, he said, "Well, you folks have been honest with me, and I'll be honest with you. I'm a secret drinker." Well, of course, it wasn't a secret to anybody that he had this problem. But he lived in fear that his drinking would be discovered and he'd be kicked out of his profession. He was a surgeon. He was a proctologist. That's a person who operates on a part of the body that gets very little sunlight. And I got to know Dr. Bob's son very well, by the way. And he told me that his father just loved his profession. Can you imagine looking at that all day long? He made this admission. Well, Bill had come out to Akron, and he was staying at the Mayflower Hotel there, which was the leading hotel in the city. And his attempt to take over this little tool machine company fell through. The stockholders voted, and they voted for the other side, and Bill lost out. And he was there that weekend in 1935, 6 months sober maybe, $10 in his pocket maybe, and a whole weekend facing him. And he even thought about going into the bar just to have a soft drink and strike up a conversation. Well, you know, that's a very dangerous thing. And he had developed the honesty by this time to know that he couldn't do that, that he wouldn't come out of that bar sober. So he decided he had to talk to somebody, and he went over and called a member, or a minister, who was a member of the Oxford group. And by gosh, the guy gave him 10 names of people who might help him. And he called all 10 of these people, but none of them could help him. However, one of them gave him the name of Henrietta Seiberlein. Now, this is the very woman who 3 weeks earlier had flushed Dr. Bob out, gotten him to admit his problems. And so she called Dr. Bob's wife, and this was the day before Mother's Day in 1935. And Bob had come home with a potted plant for his wife, Ann, but he was more potted than the plant, and now he was upstairs sleeping it off. So Henrietta got her to agree to get Bob to come to her home the next day for dinner, and because she had this man from New York who had called her, and he had said that he was a rum hound from New York who had gotten sober and a member of the Oxford group, and he wanted to talk to somebody who had a drinking problem. And when this call came, she said, "This is manna from heaven. This was guidance. This was one of those miracles, you know." 3 weeks before, Dr. Bob had admitted that he had a problem. Now, you see, what was so important there was that he had made this admission, which gave her a right to call his home and say she had somebody there to help him. If he hadn't made that admission, he could have just denied it. "No, I don't need any help," and so on. It wouldn't have worked. And we know that from our AA experience. So Bob shows up the next day, and he said he would talk to this mug for 15 minutes. And they had dinner. Bob couldn't eat anything. And then Henrietta shooed them into an adjoining room. She was living in what was called the gatehouse of Stan Hewitt. Stan Hewitt was the big 55-room mansion that had belonged in the Cyberline family for 40 years, that belonged to the Cyberline family for 40 years. Stan Hewitt means stone is found here. And, of course, later on, Bill would call Dr. Bob a rock. So that's where he found him, too, at Stan Hewitt. Well, anyway, Bill starts talking to Bob. And instead of the 15 minutes, they talk for 5 hours because Bob said that this was the first living human being he'd ever talked to who knew what he was talking about in terms of actual experience. Well, Ann, Bob's wife, was so excited about this that after a couple of weeks, she invited Bill to come live with them in their home, this home that is now the shrine there in Akron. And a couple of weeks later, Bob has to go on a medical convention trip down to Atlantic City, and he comes back drunk. Well, Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, told me that as soon as Bill knew that Dr. Bob was drunk, he packed his bags and was going to go back to New York. It was just another one of the failures. He had been working with people for 5 or 6 months, and nobody was getting sober. He was the only person staying sober. But Ann talked him into staying to give it one more try. And so he agreed. Now, I'm sure he felt pretty bad about that. Here's the man of the house who's drunk, and he's staying there and everything. He must have almost felt like a trespasser or something. But he said he would. And so for the next 3 days, he and Bob were in one room together, bedroom, on adjoining cots. And on the third day, now Dr. Bob was supposed to perform surgery. And he depended on other doctors for his referrals. And, of course, so much information had gone out in the medical community that he wasn't getting many referrals. The story was that if you sent your patient to Dr. Bob, you risked his ass. I shouldn't have said that. I apologize. But anyway, the day he was supposed to perform the surgery, Dr. Bob woke up and he looked over to Bill and he says, "I'm going to go through with it." And Bill said, "The surgery?" And Bob says, "No, I'm going to follow your program, do whatever it takes to get sober and stay that way." Well, Bill takes him to the hospital, gives him a bottle of beer on the way to the hospital, and that was the last drunk he ever had. Then Bill goes back home, and the whole day they don't hear from him, and they wonder what has happened. Well, what happened is he finished the surgery, and then he started going around Akron, seeing all the people he was on the outs with, see, working what we call the ninth step. And he came home a very happy man, and he never had another drink. And then he really became a powerhouse. He got that group going in Akron. Akron had 80 members when New York only had 20. He was a much better 12-stepper than Bill ever was, and Bill would have been the first to admit it. Well, Bill always dramatized things. He talked about that Bob came home very happy. And then he also talked about the operation. Bill says, "The patient lived." Well, who in the hell ever died of a hemorrhoid operation, you know? Anyway, that's where AA got started over there from that event. And it just always takes me away when I go over there and think about that. And a lot of thousands of other people feel the same way. Now, when I went there in 1952, and I spent the day with Bill Dotson, who was AA number 3. And Bill was a kind of a folksy type of guy. That if you were going down south and you went into a general store and there's a guy sitting there on a Cracker Barrel, you might think of that kind of a guy that always had lots of stories and everything. Very handsome guy. He had wavy white hair, thick white hair. Gosh, I'd love to have a head of hair like that. And just talked in a kind of a drawl. He had come up from Kentucky, and he'd worked in the tire factories and then gone to law school, and he was a lawyer. And his wife, whose name, by the way, was also Henrietta, she was a matron in the Akron City Jail, in the women's section of the Akron City Jail. Well, Bill and I, we drove all over Akron, and he showed me where they held the soapbox derbies and where they had built the Zeppelins in the 1920s and 30s. They built dirigibles there in Akron and everything. And we went up to St. Thomas Hospital, which is where Dr. Bob and Sister Ignatia had treated thousands of alcoholics. Sister Ignatia, by this time, was in Cleveland. But I had a good conversation with her successor, a Sister Merced. But while I was talking to Bill Dotson, I mentioned that term that I'd heard from these people out in Ventura, the guinea pig. And boy, I saw his face darken, you know, when I said that. He didn't like being called the guinea pig. And I asked him how he got that term. And he said they were having a big meeting, and Bill Wilson was talking, and Bill Dotson and some of the others were back there in a row. And when Bill got to mentioning, to the point of mentioning Bill Dotson, he turned around and gestured and said, the guinea pig. And you know, I think Bill Dotson had a resentment about that for the rest of his life. Well, would you like to be called the guinea pig? I met Bill Dotson a couple of times after that, and even stopped once in 1958 to visit his wife, his widow by that time, at the Akron City Jail in the women's section, where she was a matron. Just a very kindly woman, just wonderful, warm-hearted person. And I thought in the 1970s that she had passed on. I used to see her at the Founders Day in Akron. And I went there about 1980, and somebody said that, no, she was still living with her son over in Firestone Park. So I called her up, and this book, Dr. Bob and the Old Timers, had just come out, and I took a copy over. Well, by this time, she was blind, and I read the parts that pertained to her. Well, anyway, time went on, and I continued to be a writer and working for this company and so on. And the company was acquired by Libby Owens Ford, and they transferred me to Toledo, Ohio, where I've lived for the last 33 years. And I'd always wanted to write about Bill Wilson. In 1975, a biography came out about Bill. And then I heard that the fellow who wrote Dr. Bob's biography was also working on Bill's. Well, then a few months later, I heard that the man had died. Well, now here's another one of those coincidences. In 1973, I'd gone to New York for a meeting representing the company for the Council of Better Business Bureaus. And the guy running the meeting was a vice president of this council. And so it was at the University Club in New York City. And as we got towards noon, he turned and he said, here's the bar. You can all have a drink and we'll have lunch shortly. And he told me that I could go have a drink. And I said, well, I don't drink. And he said, well, neither do I. And so we compared notes and we're both AA members. And this was Bob Pearson. Well, what do you know? A few years later, he becomes the general manager of the General Service Offices in New York. So when I heard that there was nobody there to write Bill's biography, I got in touch with him, went down to New York and saw him, and they gave me the assignment of working on it, this book, Pass It On, and I worked on it for the next 2 years. And after I delivered two wonderful manuscripts to them, they hired a couple of other writers who screwed it up, and it finally came out in 1984 as Pass It On. And I had wanted to call it Bill W. and His Friends. And I even saw a handshake on the cover as being symbolic of Bill. He was a guy that was always had his hand out to help people. But in the process of working on that manuscript, I spent some time, a couple of weekends up at Stepping Stones, interviewing Lois, Bill's wife. You know, she was 5 years older than Bill, so I suppose when I interviewed her, she was about 89 years old. But just a wonderful person. And the first time I went up there, now this is in 1980, I got up there on a Friday, and there was a woman staying there with her. And the woman just looked like she'd been terribly ill or something. I don't think she weighed more than 80 pounds. and her name was Edna. And she just fluttered around, seemed anxious to do anything she could to help. And when I would interview Lois or read something to her, Edna would listen in. And I thought maybe she was an Al-Anon or something like that. And anyway, on Monday, a man came in an old car to take Edna to a hospice. Now, what I didn't know, and I only learned afterwards, was that Edna was a housekeeper who had worked for Lois some years before. And she was now working for some family, some affluent family as a housekeeper, and she got sick and went to the hospital. And then she couldn't stay in the hospital for any longer. I don't know why, for what reason. And the family wouldn't let her come back and stay in her room until she could go to a hospice. Well, after all, she was no longer of any use to them. And in desperation, she remembered Lois and called up Lois, told her she had no place to stay. Lois said, come on over. And she went over and was there until she went to the hospice, and about 2 months later, she died.